Hello, and welcome to Ace Pod 2.3, brought to you by the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship, which I should note, while he's not going to the courthouse, he's still taking clients. So be sure to check that out, link in the podcast notes, if you are so inclined. Today I'm very excited to welcome on a player who needs very little introduction, Stu Douglas, former two-time Michigan basketball captain, retired as the career leader in games played at Michigan in program history. He is currently residing in Israel, where he's figuring out his current contract situation during this whole pandemic situation. We discuss that, his current playing career, his time at Michigan, and a whole lot more in this half hour or so interview. Without further ado, let's get into it. I'm really excited to welcome on a two-time Michigan captain who finished his career with the school record for games played and the fifth most three-pointers in program history. Welcome, Stu Douglas. Thanks for coming on the show.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks for having me.
So I know you're currently in Israel. What is your current situation there, both with your contract and kind of your current options moving forward?
Yeah, so it's still up in the air. I mean, I've been waiting for an answer from my team for the last few days now. I mean, my agent could be calling me any minute. My mom has definitely been praying for that. I was supposed to have an answer yesterday. But basically, it's come down to teams verbalizing that players can leave, but that they need to come back if the season begins, but they won't put it in writing. So my agent advised me to stay here because, let's say the season does get canceled, then they can just turn around and say, well, we never gave written permission to these guys to go home. They breached contract and we don't have to pay them. So I don't want to go through that mess. And I want all my money. So I'm staying here until the team gives me written permission. And yeah, I mean, it's been tough, but you know, the options are pretty limited for me. And to like go through the whole court process, through FIBA and try and get money and fight the team is very tough. So we have to make sure on the player's end that me and my agent dot all of our I's and cross all of our T's. So we'll see how it plays out.
And has that been, I know you're not the only American player on your team. Mm-hmm. Are they handling it the same way that you have, or are different players making kind of different personal decisions?
They all left. I mean, even our coach, his American coach, he left. There's one guy here, but he stayed because his wife is Israeli-American. She works here. I mean, they were going to be here anyways, I think, until July or something. So I'm the only guy that, you know, is going home for the summer and then ended up staying here. So we'll see. We'll see. But that might work out for me. So, you know, the team ends up not paying them, so they have money to pay me. But we'll see. It's going to be it could be quite messy if they want it to be.
Does it help at least that, I mean, I know you've been playing in Israel, I think, since 2013, and you're a citizen at this point. So mm-hmm. does that kind of added comfort level with just knowing life over there a little bit better help you settle in a little bit?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, wherever city I'm in, it's still, you know, this country feels like a second home. So even though I'm alone and away from family and, you know, I'm dying to get back, you know, I don't feel like I'm just in the middle of nowhere. I mean, although technically I am, right? Because I'm stuck in my apartment and nobody's going out and doing anything. But it's the same situation anywhere I'm going to go. So it's not – in that regard, yeah, being in Israel and being comfortable with this country has definitely helped, you know, my decision to stay here because, you know, a lot of American guys are just so homesick and so dying to get back, and I haven't really felt that way about this place in a long time, so it's nice.
So as an athlete, how do you handle self-isolation? Is there anything that you can do to really stay in anything close to playing shape right now?
No, zero. I took like three days off, went to the beach, did like 10 sprints. Next day I woke up, I felt like I was close to just tearing my hamstring when I woke up. So I was like, man, you know, it doesn't take much to get out of shape. And if we restart the season, it's going to be ugly. It could be very ugly, especially if they want to start games right away. But staying in shape is basically close to impossible. I mean, I could run the stairs, but basically I've decided to just try and give my legs some rest. I was kind of battling some knee stuff throughout the year. So I'm just trying to give myself some rest because now we can't even go on walks. I tried to go on a walk yesterday, got stopped by a cop, told me to go home. We have like this restriction now, can't go out 100 meters past your apartment. But if they're seen on the street, they're just going to stop and tell you to go home anyway, which is good. But it's definitely next to impossible to stay in shape. I mean, really, really could if I wanted to, but you know, I'm not running the stairs every day or doing all that. It just seems insane to me when I don't even think the season's going to start back up again.
Yeah, I mean, you have obviously a unique perspective on this as a player. When you're looking at like how – I know you're a big NBA fan, like how the NBA is looking at different plans for restarting. What to you realistically is the amount of time that an athlete is going to need, as particularly a basketball player, to get back to a point where it's not, you know, risking injury to be out there and that the quality of play isn't going to take a severe drop off?
I mean, let's think about normally I have all summer to work out, right? And let's say I take like, you know, a month before I get back over to Israel and I work out hard for a month. And then you take training camp and you got about a month before games start, maybe a little more, just depends on when you have to report and what teams and country you're in. But you start getting in shape then. So it's like 2 months of getting in shape. And for the guys that stayed here, and even the guys that are at home, it's tough to work out and get a trainer and stuff like that. Even, you know, I can't get into a gym. It's impossible for me to get into a gym here. So, you know, we're not going to have a month to, you know, reacclimate ourselves to the game, and maybe not even like 2 weeks. So I don't know. It's a big risk, and it's a big hazard, you know, injury hazard for a lot of these guys. So there's a lot more concerns on that end than just simply when is the season going to start or if it can start again and what games you can get in. There's a lot that I think will go into it, but really they don't care. I mean, these leagues aren't going to really – the NBA will care, but the leagues over here won't really care that much because it's about money, and players over here don't have as much power. I mean, the EuroLeague just started a players' union, I think, last year. And they're the biggest league outside of the NBA, basketball-wise. I mean, we have a players' union, but it's not great here. And so, you know, teams control a lot of the situation. And when they say, you know, wherever the money goes, money talks. And wherever the money goes and what the teams say, you know, whether they're going to pay guys or not, and that's going to dictate a lot. So it's kind of up to them.
So is there anything that you can really do right now to kind of stay ready in case – things start back up on short notice, or is it just kind of wait and see?
Yoga and drinking wine for my mental state. try and stay a little limber and mobile. I mean, that's key for me, right? What's today? I'm turning 30 here tomorrow. So mobility and pliability is key for me anyway. So I'm trying to just stay stretching and maybe do some yoga, and that's basically all I can do.
Well, happy early birthday, man. What else kind of goes into your current isolation life right now?
Sleep, just odd sleep at odd hours. I'm talking to family. You know, we finally did the popular Zoom meeting last night. That was actually a lot of fun between the family. I'm trying to read some stuff. I found an interest in marijuana stocks, so I'm looking up research on that. So it's, I don't know, just random stuff to keep myself busy. You know, a lot of Netflix. I definitely finished Tiger King already, so you know, the usual stuff.
Absolutely. You gotta hit a Mitch McGarry to hit some business ideas around, it sounds like.
I'm down. I'm so down. I would love to talk to Mitch. I never even thought about that. That's such a good idea. Damn.
Hey, freebie. That's what you get for coming on, man.
Exactly. That's totally worth it.
So I'm going to try to move away from the pandemic content.
Okay, good.
But before all this started, I do want to hear about what your playing experience has been like in Israel. I mean, you've been there for a while now. You've really established yourself over there. What was kind of the experience of getting settled in and reaching that point?
Well, part of it is that I still feel like I haven't reached that point, right? And That has its pros and cons. You know, the pros is it keeps you motivated and keeps working. Cons is that, you know, it's hard to be at your best, you know, when you're still trying to, you know, feel like you're making a name for yourself. And sometimes you put a little pressure on yourself, but that's the name of the game for basketball in general. At least it has been for me, you know, not every guy, but it's just been years of getting used to this country and how it operates and, you know, what coaches want. How people view you versus how you view yourself. You know, you're always having to battle that. You know, I got advice from a veteran. I think it was my first or second year here. Advice from a veteran, Corey Carr. I think he actually played in the NBA for a little bit, but he's an Israeli citizen now. He lives here, played in Israel for a very long time. And he pulled me aside and he told me, the one thing you have to make sure to do to survive in this league is to just be ready to change and adapt. Every coach is different. Every team is going to be different. Every season is going to be different. You know, the season might, you know, coaches change a lot during the year. So you just have to be ready to adapt and not fight too hard against that. You know, control what you can control. And that's been, I mean, I'm learning that lesson every single day over here. So, you know, it's always reiterated with the things that go on with Israeli basketball. It's pretty entertaining.
That's awesome,
that's,
man.
That's awesome, man.
What would you say is kind of the biggest difference in terms of playing style between the league you're in right now and what we're used to seeing both in the NCAA and NBA levels?
I mean, just college, right off the bat, sets. I mean, even in the NBA, there's, you know, sets are ran better and more often. Here, it's basically half-ass sets and then just get into a ball screen. That's essentially it. I mean, there'll be some guys posting up, but a lot of it is ball screens and then a lot of one-on-one play and kind of taking advantage of mismatches. You know, we don't have like one of the biggest leagues, like tallest guys in our league. So there'll be a lot of switching, which causes a lot of one-on-one play and a lot of disruptions. So it can get kind of messy. It's not the most organized basketball. And I think that's one area that Israel needs to improve upon. Top to bottom, I mean, since I've been here, there's a lot of things, but there's, you know, it's no Spain. I played my first year in Spain and we ran sets. Guys were setting. I mean, I felt like Reggie Miller out there, right? Or Rip Hamilton. I had a 7-footer and a 6'9" guy setting pin downs on each side. And we executed those plays and fed off each other. And here it's just not quite like that. So it's not always fun, to be totally honest with you. I'd rather play like that in Spain. You know, I wish I had Spanish citizenship, but you know, I'm not going to complain. But yeah, it's definitely different.
And do you? I mean, I know there was a Detroit News article that covered your situation in Israel and also Jordan Morgan over mm-hmm. in Turkey. Do you keep in contact with your former teammates, particularly the ones who are playing overseas too?
A little bit. I mean, I talk to Jordan every once in a while, but like, who else is even? Manny was here. He was actually in Israel for about a month. We didn't play him, and I didn't get to see him or talk to him, which was unfortunate. I think he already went home. But yeah, that I think Jordan's basically like the only one. Hope I'm not forgetting anybody. But yeah, not too many guys from my time.
We're going to take a quick break and we'll be back with more from Stu Douglas on the other side. When your plumbing breaks, you hire someone who knows how to fix plumbing. When your power goes out, you hire an electrician. When you are injured in an accident, you should hire someone with experience. Jason Blankenship, a Michigan law graduate, has over 20 years of litigation experience to help you. Jason has handled matters in venues across the state and country. From various circuit courts across the state through the Michigan Supreme Court and the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals. Jason's experience in both federal and state courts makes him able to handle your complicated personal injury case. Before starting his own firm in 2014, Jason worked at a large plaintiff's firm, but he left in order to give his clients the personal attention you and your case deserve. Jason selects each case personally, and you will deal directly with Jason to resolve your case. The insurance companies have teams of lawyers on their side. You should have someone on your side, too. Call 248-533-0516. That's 248-533-0516. or email jason@blankenshiplawyer.com.
Biding your time on the other ocean, falling into line in the cold and damp. Wherever you run, you see all you leave behind you.
On the site, we've been doing some streams of Memorial games, Michigan games, to try to, you know, create some sports content when there is no sports. And the one we started off with was the 2011 game at the Breslin Center. Was that
good choice?
Was that your most memorable game or play at Michigan, or is there another one that people may not expect?
I certainly keep getting reminded of it the most, that is for sure. So it's definitely the most memorable in that way. I think playing at UConn, what year was that? My sophomore year, when they were ranked number one, and I had 20, and Ray Allen was there. And when I walked out to the court, the crowd was, or no, some kid, yeah, they already had like their students there. There was like hundreds of students already there, and some kid yelled out to me, well, you're not, that kid's not playing, or something like that. And everyone started laughing. And then I had 20 in front of, you know, one of the best shooters in the history of the NBA. So that was very memorable for me, even though we lost. But yeah, Breslin, I mean, that moment and that feeling and the hush of that crowd, that's definitely, that sticks with me kind of the most vividly, for sure.
Are you able to repeat what Novak said in the huddle earlier in that game?
I don't remember. I just found out, like, was it 2 years ago, 3 years ago? I don't know, like, well after the fact, that he was upset with me. It was something about me not getting on a loose ball or something. But I usually ignore the outbursts of emotions. I'm such an even-keeled guy. So when anybody is, like, blown up like that, I kind of just tune it out. So I wasn't really paying attention to what he was saying. I don't remember, but yeah,
so that wasn't an unusual thing from Zach.
No. Oh, no, no, no. It was something I've been used to for a long time.
What would you say is the aspect of playing for John Beilein that would surprise the most people who have followed his coaching career?
I don't know. I mean, just in general with college coaches, I mean, these guys are so good at, like, playing the sort of father figure and leader role and, like, head of a family type. And people would just be surprised at how business it is and how cutthroat it can be and ruthless and sometimes demoralizing. You know, it is a billions of dollars go into college sports. And these guys' jobs are on the line, they feel like, basically every day. And so, you know, the supportive role is not easy in that position. So, you know, you can come off like such a nice guy to the public, put on this persona, but, like, when you're in practice and you're making mistakes, it can be brutal. And you know, as a coach, like, you know, imagine your football coaches. You know, I think they get a reputation for being, like, tough guys and, like, chewing out players and being ruthless. But it's the same in basketball. It's no different. So it's – people would just be surprised at how cutthroat it is and how business it is. And, you know, if you're not producing for them, you don't really serve any function. And, you know, they want to talk about graduation rates and all that stuff. But that's more just, you know, perception than it is, like, making sure that Johnny is doing his best in school for him and his family. It's more for, like, how does it look for the team and for us and for me in general. And, you know, it's a lot more of that than people would realize.
Do you have a story from like practice or off the court that you'd be able to repeat front that kind of goes along those lines?
I mean I just told a story yesterday. The first drill I ever did at Michigan, a summer workout, I mean, he was already calling me soft. He wasn't being like completely mean about it or anything, but it was like, I thought we were like in a warm-up drill basically. And he's already telling me I'm soft and that I need to toughen up. And I was like, oh, okay, this is what it's all about. Like the recruiting and what they tell you that it's going to be like, and what they, you know, how much they believe in you and see your role, and then going through it. And it's just not that, if they don't want it to be, they can. I mean, you know, they're going to recruit, let's say like a guy like, you know, Mitch McGarry, you know, those top guys, like that's, it's going to be more like that. The recruiting pitches are going to be more reality for those guys than it is for, you know, a guy like me. But stories, yeah. I mean, every day in practice and just getting your ass chewed out all the time. I mean, just run-of-the-mill stories, really.
I'm guessing based on what you said about how people are, would be surprised how much of it is a business, I kind of know what your answer is going to be, but were you surprised when Beilein left Michigan and kind of the fashion in which he left?
So the more I read and the more I thought about it, the less surprised I got. I mean, I was surprised because I think he's just he fits perfectly in the college basketball system. And I just had big worries about him fitting with pro athletes and a player first sort of business, a very player first business actually compared to college. And it's just, it's such a culture shock for a guy like that. And for a lot of college coaches, it's very difficult. So, you know, I was surprised at first just because of that, but then I really thinking about it, you know, this guy's never been an assistant coach. He's always been a head coach. He's always been in control. You know, like anybody else, he's got an ego and he wanted to test the waters and see for himself if he could do it. And I don't blame him at all. I mean, I would, you know, it's hard to live with a regret if you don't go through it. And, you know, I think he got his answer and hopefully he can live with it. I mean, I don't think there should be any shame about it. It's just a totally different life and work environment. So yeah, I kind of went back and forth on that. And I read that he was actually really vying for the Pistons job, right? Is that correct? Like a few years ago?
Yeah, the off season before he had an interview, and then it looked like once they were going in another direction was when he kind of bowed out.
Yeah, I heard, because at first I was like, oh, okay, like that's great for contract negotiations. But then people were like, no. That was legit. Like he really wanted to do that. So that was interesting. And when I learned that, and you know, it kind of all made sense.
How much are you able to follow the current team at this point?
A little bit. I don't think I watched anything more than like 5 minutes of them. But I would, you know, look at box scores and try and follow stats. And obviously, you know, I follow you and other media guys. Guys that cover the team, and so I get a lot of the news, a lot of Michigan news on my Twitter, which I'm on probably way too much. So I can follow a little bit here and there, but you know, nothing diehardish.
So I think actually, as we were doing this, Isaiah Livers put his name in to at least
really
get feedback from the NBA.
Oh, okay, yeah.
I don't think he's in with an agent, but what kind of goes into that people, I remember when Jordan Poole and Iggy Brazdeikis declared, I think you did a whole podcast episode kind of discussing this, but kind of what goes into these decisions that people don't necessarily think about when they're saying whether it's a quote unquote good idea for a guy to go?
You're saying what fans don't realize basically?
Yes.
Yeah. Just, I think first and foremost that even for a guy like me, college basketball was not the dream. You know, I wasn't a 6-year-old kid acting like I was, you know, hitting the last second shot to win the national championship for Michigan. It was to win an NBA championship for the Pacers. And I would say most guys, that's the goal. And especially with the amount of money and not getting paid in college, it's, you know, these are business decisions. And the emotions that fans have towards their school they try and project onto these players, and it's just not the same. And it's hard to truly explain it, but that fan cares way more about the school than any player does. And yes, the player cares about the school and they care about winning, but it's just a totally different type of emotion. You know, I don't want to say that a player doesn't care. They absolutely do care. It's just totally different. And so I don't know. I see a lot of people project that onto people, like, why would you want to leave college? And it's like, because you can make a minimum of $1 million. Like, well, what the hell are you talking about, man? And you can go play overseas and make great money. The G League's even increasing their salaries, I believe. So, yeah, it's kind of surprising when you have fans being like, oh, you want to, like, why don't you want to play for no money? When you can, I mean, why would you want to play for money? You have all this opportunity to play for glory for zero money. Like, they don't really hear themselves logically, I don't think.
Yeah, I'm glad you said that, because it's been difficult sometimes to see some of the reactions to players going, particularly last year seemed to inspire a lot of vitriol.
Oh, I mean, that one pissed me off the most. Well, Jordan Poole, that pissed me off the most, because people, you know, were saying, well, he's not going to play, even though, like, he got that first round pick. That was amazing, and got his guaranteed contract. He's like, well, he's not going to play, and he's still not good enough. And it's like, who cares? He won. Like, he won. He absolutely won. And if it plays out this contract and never plays a minute in the NBA ever again, he still won. It does not matter. And I think people, I don't know, just like some people still are like hoping that he like fails so they can be right about all this stuff. And it's very odd. It's very odd when people project on other people like that. It's very confusing. And you see the kind of support, and then, you know, your support can be limited as a player. It's tied to your school, and, you know, that's not everybody. I mean, there's amazing fans out there, right? But a lot of times it can be tied to your school, and then that's another part of, like, why, you know, players would want to leave. You know, they show your true colors when that stuff comes out, and it's like, oh, okay, I'm only worth this much to you because of, you know, the jersey that I'm wearing. So it's like, why would I, you know, you get that from a lot of angles, from not getting paid, from fandom like that. So it's tough at times. I get shocked when guys come back to programs who could be first rounders and even second rounders. More shocked than I am guys leaving.
I was definitely very surprised when Trey Burke came back as a sophomore. That was
yeah, same.
Especially after I think his dorm room had been emptied out and the Daily had published that.
Yeah.
But you said something really interesting about, you know, how that fan reaction kind of shows that the love is kind of conditional. Would you say that when players are making these decisions, and also for younger players who are coming up and looking players ahead of them making these decisions, do you think that weighs into that at some point, where, you know, they're looking at this and going, you know, I can see all these fans asking for me to come back, but I've seen how they treated the player 2 years ahead of me who left, and, you know, since it's clearly conditional, you know, I might as well go.
I think maybe now more than ever, you can see opinions about yourself more than ever before. And, you know, let's take a guy like Jordan Poole, puts his name in, and let's say he's testing the waters, and then you hear all of these people saying that you can't do it, you're not good enough, blah, 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 blah. And as much as you can possibly ignore it, like, that is going to play a role. I mean, that's going to make you a little biased, and a little pissed off, especially when you believe in yourself in the first place. And you're like, no, I'm going to prove these people wrong. And then, so I'm not going to come back. And so, yeah, I think fans can sort of put their own foot in their own mouth at times. They don't even realize it, because you might think you're anonymous, but that message can definitely get across, even when guys want to ignore you. I think, you know, in terms of, like, recruiting or whatever, I don't think it plays that big of a role. There's too many other things that factor into it for that to be as big. But for a guy that's, like, you know, contemplating leaving, yeah, I mean, I'm trying to think, if I was in that position and if I would constantly being hated on when I'm testing the waters for the NBA draft, it wouldn't feel good to kind of turn back, even though it could be an extreme minority of fans. Sometimes those voices are the loudest and they can be a little overrepresented at times, which is sad, but that's just the reality of it, I guess.
Yeah, it can be tough to tune out. Before I let you go, any recent writing or podcasting projects or any plans for any? I know you've dabbled in both of those in the past.
Yeah, I don't know. Maybe this summer. You know, once I get home and get through my 2-week quarantine, I've thought about doing some episodes with my mom because she's hilarious and just talking sports with her. Because it's tough to kind of do it on my own, and then I don't know if I really want to keep asking people for interviews all the time. But there's definitely a contrast with me and my mom, I think, would be kind of funny. But I've been kind of toying around with that idea, so we'll see. I'm trying to need to convince her and do it. We'll see.
Well, I look forward to that if you're able to pull it off. Thanks again for taking the interview, and I really hope you're able to figure out your situation soon in Israel and move forward in whatever way makes sense at that point.
Yeah, no, me too. I appreciate it. Thanks for having me, man.
So that's it for this week. Thank you so much to Stu Douglas for taking the time to do this interview. I think a lot of that last portion will be important to keep in mind as, say, Isaiah Livers puts his name in for draft evaluation and Franz Wagner may soon follow him. Next episode will be whenever I get around to it. Schedules have kind of gone by the wayside these days, although I'm doing my best to stick to a routine. It'll be nice if there's some content to cover soon, but if there is, we'll have more episodes coming to you. Thanks again for everyone for listening. Thanks to the law offices of E. Jason Blankenship for sponsoring the show. And thanks again to Stu for enlightening us with his experiences. Until next time.